This episode of the OCD Stories is brought to you by NoCD. I got to talk with NoCD's Head of Clinical Services, Dr. Patrick McGrath, about delivering therapy through the NoCD platform.
And I'm really enjoying telehealth because now I'm really in the environment with people where they're experiencing a lot of their OCD concerns, right? Before, I would rely on them telling me about it, describing what the room looked like. They'd have to bring pictures in of, all right, here's the bed that's contaminated that I don't sleep in anymore. Now, turn your phone around and let's see the bed and let me watch you do an exposure on it. I mean, I'm live in the moment. I don't need proxies anymore. I don't need you to rub a rag on the bed and then put it in a bag and then bring it to my office. Then we'll do exposures to the rag that touched the bed. Now, go touch the bed and I'm going to watch you and I'm going to coach you through this whole experience. So to have the ability to actually be in any environment where somebody has a fear in their own comfort level of where they're at in their own home, which in one room is comfortable, as I'm trying to say, and another is not. Let's walk from that comfortable room to that not comfortable room and let's really do the exposures right there.
NoCD, accessing a community and an OCD therapist just got easier. For more information on therapy plans, visit go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link is in the episode description. Hey guys, and welcome to episode 218 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I got back on psychotherapist Shiva Rajai. Shiva has been on the show before, but I got back on to talk in particular about relationship OCD. And in this episode, I get an update on Shiva, her relationship to relationship OCD, the obsessions and compulsions that can go along with relationship OCD, types of exposure and response prevention for relationship OCD, if the romantic partner can come into the therapy room, and if so, what's that like, psychoeducation for the partner. We talk about the fear of being cheated on or the fear of cheating on the partner. We talk about the philosophy of relationships, kind of generally wider than just OCD, how society, at least Western society, may view relationships. We go into that a bit. Words of Hope, Shiva's new book, which isn't out yet. We talk about that and much, much more. I think this is quite a wide-reaching episode for anyone affected by relationship-themed OCD. Now, if you have relationship OCD and you listen to this podcast, you may have heard an episode I did about 4 years ago with my then-girlfriend, now-wife. I've recently taken that down, so I'm just letting you know in case you're wondering where that's gone. I decided to take it down because there were things I said that didn't fully align with me anymore, so I made the decision to take that down. But if you did listen to it, then I hope it helped you and you found it interesting. But hopefully this episode goes some way to replacing that. I thoroughly enjoyed chatting with Shiva and hope it helps. On the podcast today, I have Shiva Rajai. Shiva is a psychotherapist who specializes in the treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder and other related disorders, anxiety disorders. Shiva did a TED talk called Addicted to the Answer, Anxiety in the Age of Information, which made up the core of our first podcast together. We've since done a couple others, including a member episode, but welcome to the podcast, Shiva.
Oh, thank you so much for having me again, Stu. So great to be here.
It's good to have you on again. And we are going to talk specifically about relationship OCD today. Before we get into that, just a general update from you or anything else you wanted to share on, or a recap of kind of your story, which you would have shared in our first podcast together.
Of course. So I am a psychotherapist with a group private practice practicing in Southern California. And I know we spoke a little bit on our member pod and the member podcast too, but thankfully things have been going great for us. We've been expanding. We're looking to hopefully add some group options, some more ways to sort of serve the community. As far as personally, it's been just a sort of a real pleasure to be on this podcast a few times with you and to be able to sort of speak my story. Also, I love listening to this podcast. I love hearing the experts come on, the stories that you have from other members of the community. But I myself have OCD. It's probably been over 10, 15 years now since I've been diagnosed. using, you know, have been treated using cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure and response prevention. And I was able to speak about it on the UCLA's Royce Hall stage, and sort of a coming out moment for me. But it's been a really big part of my work, of course, personally and professionally. So there's been a real intersection for me between my own journey and process treating OCD, managing OCD, and then, of course, my work with clients, my clinical work, and the passion of that process definitely intertwines. The pain of it intertwines too. So I'm deeply embedded in this work, in this community, and just really grateful to be here again with you.
Yeah, thank you, and good roundup. And I will link to the TED Talk, which was great, and which is how I first found out about you, and also, you know, our episodes together for those interested. So my first question on this topic really is, what is your relationship to relationship OCD?
That's a great question. So it is relationship OCD. I suppose I'll start out personal and then go professional, but it has been one of the themes that I have personally struggled with, something that I've had to contend with, to manage, something that's come up for me in multiple relationships, but probably most notably in my marriage. And it's something that I really do cope with as one of my more main themes. And how that's translated, I suppose that's a good segue from our last point, but it has also become sort of a professionally a topic of interest for me and a topic of exploration for me, and something that I really enjoy working with clients and just trying to understand a bit more. Of course, knowing that at the end of the day, it's obsessive compulsive disorder, but that this particular theme and some of its manifestations, I find very interesting and really topical, you know, because people are increasingly struggling in relationships. And I think ROCD is one way that we're seeing that struggle manifest, and we're getting a lot more interest in the topic and a lot more people coming in, you know, reading about it for the first time, wanting treatment, wanting to learn more.
Yeah, good explanation there, and thank you for sharing your personal experience, I should say. Okay, so I guess it'd be good before we expand further on that, just to understand, you know, what are some of the common obsessions and compulsions that one would find with this particular flavor of OCD?
Sure. So common obsessions with relationship-based OCD are going to be broken down into partner-focused or relationship-focused. But sometimes that delineation it's not necessary. It's not necessarily that important. The point is it's really a focus and fixation on the rightness of the relationship or the sort of the health or temperature of the relationship. So common obsessions would be wondering, what if I don't love my partner enough? What if I'm not attracted enough to my partner? What if this isn't the right match? What if I'm in denial and I don't really love this individual? The other sort of way to look at it is, what if I'm not loved enough? What if I am not enough for this relationship? So quite a few concerns, again, around that feeling of rightness as it manifests in generally romantic relationships. And then as far as compulsions go around this, so you've got really, you know, thousands of ways that this can manifest, but some of your more common compulsions that your listeners might recognize would be avoidance of relationships that might seem, this term is a bit clinical, but seem viable. So sometimes individuals will feel less triggered in relationships that don't have as much lasting power. But when you find somebody who's really interested in you, really available for a romantic long-term relationship, that can be quite triggering, and the individual might find themselves avoidant of that. There can be a process of really constant, seemingly endless checking of the person's own emotional response vis-a-vis their partner, but then also scanning of the partner. There can be quite a bit of reassurance seeking, especially in this subtype, I think, because there's an acceptable conversation around relationships. That's part of how we bond with people. So there can be quite a few instances where it's very normal to sort of ask your friends and family members about what they think about your relationship. It's maybe less typical for us to go and say, do you think we're a murderer or are we dangerous? So there ends up being a lot of reassurance giving, seeking, taking. And then, of course, you know, maybe hours of mental rumination. wondering, is the right person for me? Are these feelings true love? You know, in this instant, I didn't feel this level of attraction or arousal. Is that meaningful? Are we doomed?
Yeah, good explanation. And where you said scanning of the partner, is that looking at their body language, as in I just said something to them and they seem closed off? That probably means they don't love me, X, Y, and Z. Is it that sort of?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm nodding my head as you're saying that. Definitely that. It could be just a hyper-focusing even on physical qualities and attributes. So, for example, you know, really fixating in on the way a person's hairstyle is, or the way they groom their facial hair, or their body type, really anything. So it's a bit of a hyper-focusing on scanning and hyper-focusing on that individual or their responses to us.
So then, like you said, the body part, for example, it could be the way they're wearing their hair. Therefore, it could be I hate the way people wear that hair like that. Therefore, that means X, Y, and Z, and all, making all these assumptions. When in reality, if anxiety wasn't there, probably wouldn't care about the hairstyle.
Yes, so there definitely is that experience you're describing of like this. Sometimes I talk about it a bit as a. It seems almost as if the reaction or sort of the threat response feels disproportionate. So something where another person would go, well, yeah, you know, I don't love their nose. That's not my, you know, favorite part of their face, but that's okay given that I like the person in general. With obsessive compulsive disorder and then this subtype, we might fixate quite a bit on that, you know, really need to sort of fix or solve or come to a feeling of cleanliness in the mind around that perceived flaw. So very much an exaggerated threat response to, you know, what is human in our partners. Everybody has qualities that we might not love.
Yeah, absolutely. No one's perfect, including ourselves. We won't spend long on this, but I guess I just kind of want to make the distinction. So you said about romantic, it's primarily around romantic relationships. I remember, and obviously whenever you read about relationship OCD online and whenever it's been talked about on this show, it's very much from the romance point of view. But I remember reading in, I think it was Guy Doran's studies, who was on the show almost 4 years ago. He didn't say it then, but I remember reading one of his studies. He talked about it could be the relationship with God or a relationship with family or friends. And I probably need to check that literature again. But yeah, do you ever see people with this kind of the same sort of worries you'd find within romantic relationship OCD, so to speak, but you'd see it on, does my friend like me? You know, they're not responding to messages. Does my, you know, that sort of, yeah, I don't know, I'm mumbling, but.
No, absolutely. I've also read what you're referring to, that it refers maybe more broadly, ROCD can refer more broadly to the relationships that we have. Like you said, the relationship with God, with our children, with our friends. I've also seen that, you know, in practice, with clients coming into my office, they tend not to be as distressed about that, perhaps. So that might be why that doesn't come quite as much to the forefront. Or perhaps that's somehow better categorized as being a morality-based obsession if it's about God. I think they become subsumed somewhat in other categorical breakdowns.
Like religious OCD or,
Absolutely. But I do believe, and I believe Guy Doran has broken it down to be that it is about the relationship. Again, 97% of what I see with it is romantic relationships. But that could very much be because that tends to be an area we really want to optimize.
Yes.
Whereas if a friendship is somewhat less than ideal, we have a bit more tolerance for that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it is predominantly the romance side of things. I guess I just wanted to flag that just in case anyone is worrying about a relationship with a friend or something. And I have seen that around the internet a few times, but yeah, it's nowhere near as, well, it's nowhere near as written about as romance. And I guess it makes sense. Romance has plagued our world for centuries in a good way. When doing exposure work with clients with relationship OCD, from here on referring it to it from a romantic point of view. Again, it depends per client, but what would a rough exposure session look like for this client?
Yeah, so exposures are, of course, incredibly personal, and so you'd want to absolutely assess the individual and what their particular fear might be. Generally with relationship OCD, so I'm speaking much more in general here, there is an aversion to feeling vulnerable and feeling exposed. There can be behaviors that keep the individual feeling safe. So that can be more avoidant type behaviors. For example, not reaching out in as expressive of a way as they might truly feel, avoiding acts of commitment, more acts of intimacy, closeness, a bit of a feeling of hot and cold. So that can be sometimes what partners describe, is that their partner with OCD can feel a bit hot and cold, so in one day, out the other. So some of the work of the exposure and response prevention here, exposure and ritual prevention, is to keep the individual in a state of connection while managing that the up and down of the anxiety. So to ask the individual, if your values are to be with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, your fiance, your husband, your friend, right, and you're experiencing this really intense threat response in that connection, can we use the exposure to sort of keep you in that connection and to ultimately show you that you can feel more safe in that connection, less triggered potentially in that connection, right? And that we don't have to listen to our thoughts and our feelings, which might be telling us, this isn't safe, this feels wrong, you can't handle this, X, Y, and Z. So that's ideologically what it looks like, Stu. And then sort of in practice, it would be, again, very tailored to the individual. So, writing emotional effusive text messages, maybe a couple times a week is kind of a common exposure. Doing scripting around the idea of making a mistake. So writing, for example, the story script around the fear of, what if I commit to this individual and I realize 5 years down the road, I was lying to myself about my love for them, or, putting on a fake, one of the favorite ones is to sort of put on a fake wedding ring or to go wedding ring shopping with your partner. These kinds of things really trigger that fear. Yeah. And then we're asked to cope with it in a more corrective manner.
Yeah. So really targeting whatever their core fear is around the relationship. And yeah, so for example, if it's the idea of getting married is maybe something they want to do in the future, but doing it sooner, so to speak, or even the idea of doing it in the distance is anxiety provoking, because once I get married, that's forever, so to speak, and therefore what happens if I'm in the wrong relationship, which is a common worry, one I had. So getting them to do that sort of jewelry shopping or putting on a fake ring is bringing that forward and facing that fear sort of now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, like you said, very dependent on the individual. And ultimately, almost all of us are trying to avoid negative emotion. So if you boil all themes down, we're trying to avoid pain and discomfort. The pain and discomfort in ROCD it's not dissimilar to the pain and discomfort we'd feel in any other type of theme. But it can sort of look like, what if I'm making a mistake, or what if I'm putting my heart out there and I'll get hurt? And so sometimes I call that almost a fear of vulnerability, or kind of that's what we tend to try to work on, to manage that fear and to make that a bit more to size, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. No, thank you. And I guess on the flip side of that is let's say that you've got the person to get the fake wedding ring and to wear it around for a week or a day or whatever it is. But obviously they could undo the work of facing that fear if they do the compulsions, whether that's like, okay, so I'm doing this exposure, I've got this fake wedding ring on, but now I'm going home and I'm asking my girlfriend, boyfriend, whoever, kind of, what does this mean? When will we get married? And whatever the compulsion is, the reassurance seeking. How do you work with that to not get them to undo that exposure?
Absolutely. So, right, if a person is, for example, very nervous about maybe committing, even though that's their value system, they're nervous about it because it feels like they're getting locked in to something they can't be certain of, which of course they can't, right?
Yeah.
When they put that wedding ring on, that's going to spike them up quite a bit, or foreseeably it will. And so by this point in time, let's say by the time you get to ERP, you've worked with the client on sort of understanding the process of anxiety, and that oftentimes what we are experiencing as this extreme threat response is not an accurate representation of the actual threat in this environment. So for example, nobody wants to go through divorce and separation, but it also doesn't mean our lives are over. Many people move on after divorce and separation. Many people, you know, make mistakes in this life, and you can choose to sort of regroup from that and move forward into meaning or not. But to sort of view the work of the exposure is that we essentially would put on that wedding ring, have the rise in anxiety, or for example, listen to, you know, love songs. I mean, people can be triggered by Taylor Swift songs or romantic comedies, and to watch that and allow the anxiety to sort of rise up, sit with that anxiety, tolerate that experience without telling your brain, yes, that anxiety is correct and valid, I'm going to run from it, and essentially allowing that anxiety to sort of come down on its own. Likewise, to also learn as an individual, we can handle high levels of anxiety without needing to respond to them with, for example, avoidance, or the example that you used to, like reassurance, right? Oh, I'm wearing this wedding ring and I feel very anxious. I'm going to go to my partner and say, well, how do we know we're the right match? Right? Well, I'm wearing this wedding ring and I don't feel 100% ready. What does that mean that I don't feel 100% ready, right?
Yeah.
So sort of managing that and then doing it, of course, with quite a bit of repetition. One time would not be enough.
No, of course. Thank you for that explanation. And how do you bring in the romantic partner into this? Because I guess if you send them on their way with, again, I'll stick with the ring for continuity. If you send them on their way with that fake ring for the week and they've got to wear it around, but their partner's oblivious to this, I can imagine if that person isn't committed to withholding from the compulsions, they may just think, well, my partner doesn't know, so I'll ask reassurance anyway. And Shiva's, you know, in her office, she doesn't know I'm going to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there has to be, of course, quite a bit of willingness on the client's end to be trying to change and correct the behavior so that they can rewire the programming to teach their brain, you know, yes, a commitment and choosing is scary, but it's ultimately doesn't have to be, you know, a life ender, even if I make a mistake. So there has to be willingness on the client end. Thankfully, again, with working with individuals with anxiety and OCD, I don't find that they lie to their therapist very much. I don't know if it's, I think we find ourselves generally too morally inclined to lie to our therapist too much, but now that I've said it, I've got a knock on wood. So that would be one piece of it. It's interesting you ask this because just this week I've actually worked with a couple of individuals who have chosen to bring their significant other in for a, sort of a consultation type session. And of course it's completely up to the pairing. Some people choose not to share their journey and their experience with their partners, but I would say most do. And in that case, there's a lot I could say about the partner's role, and perhaps we might get to that, but I do think it could be very helpful for a partner to be aware of what's going on, because like you said, somebody comes home with a wedding ring, that's odd, but also because generally by the point in time that someone's seeking treatment for ROCD, there's probably been some waves caused in the relationship as a result of this sort of approach avoidant type presentation, and the partner's got to be wondering what's going on, and probably is beginning to feel potentially a bit insecure. So it can be very helpful to have a partner come in and just get them on board with, you know, first and foremost, this is really about the sufferer's relationship to discomfort much more than it is about their relationship to you, actually. So a bit of psychoeducation and then to have them be on board and to not, like you said, give in to that reassurance, though that seems to be the most natural thing to do when you love someone.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And being the partner can obviously be incredibly tough to hear your loved one questioning whether you're the right person or whether they should be with you or whether your hairstyle's funky or whatever it is. And I guess, and until you fully understand what OCD and anxiety are or is, I can imagine it could create more arguments and more fights, which is only going to exacerbate the OCD cycle, because it's almost feedback of, see, I was right to think they were potentially not right or whatever it is. So I guess, do you see kind of a relief on the partner's face when, I guess, they start to get it, that it's not about necessarily about them. It's this anxiety that's driving their partner.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly sometimes I would say I see relief. I think I see more of the relief, or I certainly hear it reported back to me when the individual has learned to really manage the symptoms, because that's when I think the partner is actually starting to experience some stability. Okay. in their loved one's sort of presentation. So I can't lie and say right when they come in and I give them the education on it, they go, oh, fantastic, it's not me. But yeah. But I also can't imagine it's not a start, at least. Yes. For the couple to feel more balanced and like, okay, we know what's going on. And, you know, the other bit of it is just to highlight again and again that something I think is so interesting with this particular subtype or this theme is how much feedback is acceptable to be given to us from others. And I think that is in some ways fairly unique. Relationships are something that we just all talk about. We love talking about them. The media will tell us all about them, how they should be, how they should look, how they should feel. And so if you imagine in a relationship, two people are talking about how they feel about one another, on the surface, that doesn't seem in any way, shape, or form to be a problem. So it might be after the, 40th or 50th time they've been having the same conversation that somebody starts to go, wait a second, right? This isn't adding up for me. We're having the same type of conversation over and over again. Or no matter how much I reassure my partner, she's not finding relief. And that's oftentimes the point when people do start to do a bit more digging. Unfortunately, some damage can be done at that point in time as well.
Yeah. Okay, no, thank you for sharing that. And just, is there anything else on spouses or partners that that you want to share, I guess?
My one piece of advice, especially for, I think this could be true for almost any theme, but especially I think for ROCD, because it's happening in the context usually of, again, a romantic relationship, usually a committed romantic relationship, I would ask your listeners to try their best not to share content with their partners. So what I mean by content versus process is I find it useful to be able to cue your partner in, you know, hey, I'm having an anxious day, or I'm sorry, I might feel a little bit off, you know, I'm just a bit anxious today, I'm going through something a bit today, I'm feeling a bit not myself. That's process, that's explaining the process. But when we go to our partners and we say, today I worried about your hair, you know, I worried about if I could stand how it looks for the next 40 years, or today I noticed an attractive man walking down the street and I wondered what it might be like to be with him, that's content. And that's oftentimes just an outsourcing of our anxiety onto the partner. Usually that's seeking reassurance. And aside from it being unhelpful from an anxiety recovery standpoint, it's just a hurtful process in a committed relationship. Yeah. And I think we can still access support by sharing our process while protecting our relationships by keeping content between us and our clinicians. So sort of in the therapy room.
You as the therapist take the brunt of that, and it doesn't get passed on to the partner.
It doesn't also get validated by being passed on to the partner, right? Because when we express it, we're also telling our brain, well, this concern is real. And when we really work to understand our OCD, of course, the root of it could be, I'd prefer if your hairstyle was different. Yeah. But that preference gets ticked off in our brain as something that must be checked off before we can be settled. And we must, you know, learn to allow that unchecked box to exist. So by expressing that concern to our partner, we're also validating it in our own minds. We're saying, no, this is important enough to continue bringing up.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Good point. Okay. So this is a listener question. I keep a record of them, and this, so I was digging through my archive of potential future questions. This is one on relationship OCD. So it was just how to work with the fear of being cheated on, and fear of cheating on the partner.
So both ways, yeah.
Yeah.
Fear of being cheated on and fear of cheating on the partner. So one of the things we'd want to look at there is, you know, first and foremost, I like to check in and just see if there's any kind of real history behind that. I do like to check in. So is there any unprocessed experience from your past that you might have gone through that might, you know, really be keeping this fear quite turned on in your brain? If so, that's something I'd want to address. Sometimes there can be attachment type injuries that inform our OCD. So I want to be very clear, that doesn't mean you have to have had anything that went on in your childhood or in a previous relationship in order to have OCD. But if you have, for example, you grew up in a home where you were not given as much attention as you would have wanted, or you had a parent who was extra controlling, that can become almost like a information that the OCD then picks up on and kind of perpetuates. So I would do probably an initial check-in on that. Just want to see what's going on there. But once we moved past that, I would essentially be looking at this and treating this as if it were any other type of thematic content. So let's be rational first and foremost. Let's try and look at, has this individual ever actually cheated on you? Have you ever actually done anything to say that you might be unfaithful in a relationship? Assuming that the answer to that was no, right? We'd sort of categorize this as probably the realm of anxiety, OCD, a bit irrational. And then we'd really want to work with tolerating that possibility. Because, of course, in our work, there's no way to get a 0% chance that you're not going to be cheated on.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I could be getting cheated on right now, right? I mean, we don't know. So
yeah.
There's no way to know with 100% certainty we're not being cheated on. There's no way to know with 100% certainty something might not slip one day and we might not do something we're not happy about. But we can tolerate that possibility with the use of some restructuring and a lot of sitting with and allowing that discomfort. And that's kind of really where the work would come in between client and clinician.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you for that. That was an interesting one. But yeah, it all goes back to the, like you said, the uncertainty. We don't know. We can't know. And sitting with that. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely.
No, thank you. And a question I like to ask on these theme-specific episodes is CBT and ERP as effective for relationship OCD as other OCD themes?
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
Cool.
Shall I elaborate on that? Or is that just sort of a... No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, just to sort of reiterate that the themes are manifestations and they tend to be common concerns for us. So many people worry about relationships. Many people want to get relationships right. Many people feel vulnerable in relationships. They feel they can feel exposed. They can feel afraid of getting hurt. And so anytime that the stakes feel that high, whether it's, again, the relationship with your romantic partner, the relationship between parent and child, like you said, your relationship to your faith, your spirituality, our threat response is going to be cruising at a little bit of a higher, you know, higher rate than normal. And that's why you see these clusters of themes that sometimes appear with OCD. But at the end of the day, if you never called it OCD and you simply treated it as if it were OCD, foreseeably you'd get the same results.
Yeah. Good. No, thank you for clarifying that. So back in, I think it was May 2015, when you were working at OCD LA, you wrote an article with Tom Corboy called OCD, Relationship OCD and the Myth of the One. And the one is in kind of speech marks. And I guess my give you background, my history with this article, so I was still kind of in the throes of OCD. And OCD still bothers me from time to time, absolutely. But I guess I'm lucky in the sense that it's not so focused on the relationship anymore. But relationship OCD was one of my core themes at the time, and it was really troubling me. And it was putting my now relationship with my wife at risk. And I remember coming across that article, and it was, you know, beautifully written out, the kind of understanding what it is, the treatment, other things that can help, but also like philosophy around relationship and hence the myth of the one, or, you know, is there such a thing, etc. So that article really helped me, and I probably used it as reassurance quite a lot, and would revisit it whenever I was having a bad day. But yeah, I needed that at the time, and I'm sure it got me through a dark patch. But there was a bit in there towards the end that I remember printing out, cutting out, and keeping in my wallet. So whenever I needed just a reminder, and I just wanted to read it and then get you to just explain whatever it is about it. So it's only after divorcing your ROCD will you be able to clearly see the person in front of you. By pulling the plug on this most toxic of relationships and accepting uncertainty as a normative experience, you can begin a deeper commitment to intimacy with the person you love.
Yeah. Well, I'm so honored that resonated with you. And, you know, I think this article came, of course, from a personal place for me as well. And of course, from a professional place at that time. But I really do believe, I'm so grateful you picked up on, I do really believe there's a philosophy that, in at least in my work with ROCD, I do try to challenge. And it goes a little bit deeper than, of course, there's the clinical application, there's the CBT and the ERP, we want to practice acceptance. But I think we really come up against the way in which the idea of the one, the idea of being saved by relationships, by love, by this idea, by this fantasy, has really hindered us. It's done exactly the opposite. And when you think about an individual struggling with anxiety and OCD, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of discomfort. How tempting to want to buy into, again, the myth we're all sold, which is that you will find this person, they will take away all your pain. If it's the right one, you won't have any doubts. Mm-hmm. If it's the right one, you won't have any uncertainty. Everything will be effortless, including intimacy, right? And you'll never really have to work again. I mean, I know it's almost laughable when we voice it, but implicitly, many of us believe this. I believed this. And I think that one of the things that happens is when we get caught up in trying to find and optimize and really we believe that this is our due right to be with a perfect person and to not feel discomfort, we are not opening ourselves up to seeing that relationships are really a journey. They're absolutely, in the words of David Schnarch, he says they're people growing machines.
I like that. Yeah.
I love that. I love his last name too, but yeah. I love the quote so much that relationships are these vehicles for us to become more of ourselves, to challenge ourselves. They're not meant to be easy street. There's no growth in easy street. In fact, we tend not to be attracted to what is so simple. So I think our goal in ROCD treatment and work is to, like I said, there, sort of divorce ourselves from this relationship to needing to feel certain that becomes what we're so dependent on. And instead, we open ourselves up to uncertainty. And what we're able to see behind the mask of fear is the person who we probably knew deep down all along, we love deeply and want to go on this journey with. But it can be very, very foggy along that road sometimes when the fear creeps in. You know, it's very easy to lose your path.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the society has not helped with at least Western's view of romance. Certain film houses or film brands, especially aimed towards children's type films.
You won't name any names, but
they've really done, at least historically, they've changed a lot now, which is great. But historically, yeah. And even those types of films, but like chick flicks or rom-coms, you know, I love those films. But
absolutely.
There's so many of them, they're so bad. Like they end on bliss. But they don't show you what happens a year down the line in the relationship where something hiccups and, you know, they have to work through it, or couples counseling or whatever it is, you know.
It's that
Same.
last scene in the, if you've seen the last scene of the movie The Graduate,
Yeah.
where two characters have just gotten married kind of impulsively and they're riding off into the sunset, and the camera just stays on them for that like extra two beats, and you see their face go from the elation of, oh my God, we just did this crazy thing, we got married, to pardon my language, but holy shit, what have we done? And there's, they just, the camera just pauses to let that reality set in for just 1 second before, the camera goes dark. And it's, I think it would be one thing if we were able to see what we are given by the media as fantasy and as a story, because there's absolutely a role for fantasy and a story. This isn't about vilifying, the role of fantasy, which is escapism. It's absolutely okay, but we conflate the two sometimes. And then what we expect of our very good, very solid, very generative relationships becomes unrealistic. And I think that's where, unfortunately, we experience a lot of dissonance, and we become unhappy.
Yeah, very much so. And it's probably not even just romance. It's probably other things films are responsible for. But yeah, it's when we confuse fantasy as documentary, almost seeing like, here's a
Absolutely.
rom-com, oh, that's what romance should be like. No, it's fantasy, it's story, like you said. Yeah, and good stories should be different from reality, at least fictional stories. Okay, cool. No, but yeah, thank you for writing that article. I really, it helped me a lot, and especially that last bit.
Of course, I'm so glad. That's an honor.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I will link to it in the show notes for anyone interested. And but don't use it as reassurance. Okay, so just words of hope for those with this particular theme.
So, my word of hope, of course, to start out by saying that the prognosis is positive. That's a clinical way to say it, but recovery is possible, management is possible. Your relationship can heal from this if it's been wounded from this. You can absolutely do the work that's being asked of you here, which is, you're stepping into, you're at the sort of gateway of stepping into a lot of vulnerability, but also the potential for a lot of love and a lot of growth. And you've got to manage your anxiety, which is standing at the door of it. So it is absolutely possible. And what's more, it's a journey that I think is really, really worth taking. So it will make not only your relationships better, more loving, more generative, more close, more intimate, but I think the theme is pretty clear here. It will also make the relationship with yourself all of those things. You will become much more close to yourself, much more balanced in your relationship to discomfort personally. So this is a vehicle for personal growth. And it is an absolutely, it's a drivable car. Sometimes it's a bit of a stick shift, and it's a bit of an incline. But it's doable. And I've seen it done, and I've done it myself. And one of the most amazing, some of the most amazing moments in my work as a clinician, I think particularly because this theme is personal for me, is I love getting wedding thank you cards. Not because I attend weddings, but sometimes people will be so kind as to write me and send me pictures from their weddings, individuals who I've worked with ROCD. And I just know what it takes to get to that moment. And not that their work is done, but for them to sort of feel maybe on a wedding day or on an anniversary or some milestone in their life that they were able to connect and feel that love, not because their partner's perfect, not because they're perfect, but because they've changed their relationship to discomfort. Those moments are absolutely achievable.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with that for many reasons. Okay, so you are writing a book on this particular theme. I know it's not ready yet, but is there anything you want to share on that?
Yeah, I'm really excited to be able to write a book on this. I think excited to sort of present something that's going to be a bit of a mixture of some of the philosophy we've talked about, which I think is an important part in managing ROCD. So really looking at context and framework, almost the narrative here that's been created for us around love and what it's supposed to look like. But then also the book is going to be a treatment guide for clinicians and for also your sort of your layperson and your clinician as well, to be able to walk through the steps of treating ROCD, very specific interventions tailored specifically to this this theme. And I'm very excited to get into it and to even like expand more, you know, knowledge around it, learn more, gather more information, look at more research. I'm in the very beginning stages of it now, but I'm hoping that it will be done sometime early next year. And so I'll be in quite a process for the next year with it, but just really hoping we can shine some more light on this theme. And again, even more broadly, just on, I think, put a bit of a light on the pulse of our expectations around relationships in general, which I really believe have to be updated. I think they have to be a bit updated.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's not just people with OCD on this particular theme. It's a lot of people's views of relationship. I don't want to say aren't quite right. That's not fair. But you know what I mean? They're not. It's again, same way people with OCD may have been misled a bit by popular culture around romance, I think general society has as well. Obviously, it's amplified within OCD tenfold.
Yeah, I like the way Esther Perel sort of talks about how what we used to once ask of a village, we now ask of a person. Yeah. And I think that that's an apt way to describe exactly that, that, you know, we used to have somebody to go to. We had friends that were external from the relationship. We had sometimes lovers that were external from the relationship. We had confidants that were external from the relationship, guidance. And now we ask one person to be absolutely everything to us. And us to them. And of course, we are surprised and disappointed when nobody can quite meet that. And so I think it's learning to be realistic so that we can fully enjoy, because a good enough relationship sounds like settling, but it's really the absolute best we can get when we're dealing with our humanity and with another person's humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. I love Esther Perel.
I do too.
Yeah, she's great. So, I'm going to change the question now. So, recently I asked you advice for your 20-year-old self. So, I know it wasn't that long ago, but advice for your 30-year-old self.
Okay, advice for my 30-year-old self. I would ask 30-year-old Shiva to invest in Bitcoin, maybe. I don't know. let's see. I suppose I would probably encourage that version of me to continue to do, I think, what all of us are trying to do, but to continue to trust and to stay open and to not be afraid or try to manage the fear around that vulnerability, which, again, I think we're talking about it in the context of relationships, but so many of us feel just being alive and walking about every day, having to manage anxiety and sort of the depression that comes with it and the invisibility that comes with it. So I think letting myself know that, hey, you're doing okay. You're always doing the best that you can. And usually when I'm doing it right, I'm open and I'm trusting. And usually when I find that I'm in distress and discomfort, if I look, I've closed off somewhere and I've become, my expectations have gotten the best of me and fear has kind of crept up again. And it's just the gentle process of sort of uncurling those fingers again, right? Releasing the grip and just, okay, get back to work. Yeah. So I think that's what I'd tell 30-year-old Shiva and all Shivas from here on out.
Okay, great. Thank you. So you've got a billboard in California. What do you want written on that billboard?
Love is a choice. Love is a choice. Love is not just a feeling. It doesn't just happen to us. It doesn't just take you over. It's not meant to save you. It's not meant to cure you. It is a choice, and it is a choice that you can make ecstatically, and it's a choice that you can recommit to time and time and time again. If you're doing it right, you recommit to it maybe countless times over your life, over your marriage, over the course of your relationship. But it is a choice that we make, and it is not simply something that sweeps us up and takes us along for a ride.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, so a question came to mind, but all I'm going to do is I'm going to save that for when you come back on to talk about your book. So is there anything else that you want to share today?
As usual, just a big thank you to you, to this community. I think as a note in particular to the ROCD, to everyone listening, really, to everyone listening, and I think today's ROCD is specific, but this applies to all your listeners, is just to please, you know, if you're beating up on yourself today for the thoughts that you're having, if you feel like a bad partner because your brain is saying things that you think are totally unacceptable, and you know, if you told somebody, they might tell you that they were unacceptable or that they did sound horrible. If you're beating yourself up today as you're listening to this, I just want to remind you that you don't have a choice in what your brain is thinking, and this doesn't define or characterize you in any way. And I really, really, really hope that you can have compassion for yourself. And just remember, you're doing the absolute best you can today in your relationship, in your progress, in your recovery. And just to remember that we're all humans out here, and we're all in the same boat together.
Yeah, I agree. Great way to end. And as always, thank you for coming on, for especially talking about this topic. I guess for influencing me all those years ago, and hopefully helping others.
Oh, thank you so much, Stu. It's always a pleasure, and so wonderful. And thank you so much again, as always, for the work you do for us.
So there you have it. Thanks to Shiva for her time, and to you guys for listening. And don't forget, this podcast is sponsored by NoCD. To find out more about NoCD and their therapy plans, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories. Or the link will be in the episode description. I've also recorded two mini bonus episodes with Dr. Patrick McGrath and Anil from NoCD. And if you'd like to listen to those, you can do so at theocdstories.com/NoCD. That's NOCD. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Till we speak, take care.